I want to address the issue of searching for a solution. Not surprisingly, there is a raging debate in policymaking circles, in the pages of academic journals and in the international press, about how we are going to confront the challenges of economic development. In particular, how to effectively resolve the tensions between the pressures on the environment and scarce resources associated with economic growth, and the unsatisfied needs of billions of poor people all over the world. One popular strain of thought in this debate argues roughly as follows, and I'm quoting from the New Scientist article alluded to earlier. The planet is not salvageable as long as international capitalism prevails, with its focus on growth and profits at all costs and predatory resource capture. If we are truly concerned about helping the poor rather than the rich, we need a new development model, unquote, is how Susan George and Andrew Sims put it in the 18 October 2008 issue of the New Scientist. Susan George, for instance, advocates what she calls ecological Keynesianism, drawing parallels with the Allied response to fascism during the Second World War and the swift transformation of the economy to a war footing. A massive shift of resources and priorities by governments to deal with the upcoming environmental catastrophes is what is needed, a sort of third way, quote, between red in tooth and claw capitalism and a worldwide uprising as unlikely as it is utopian, unquote. Too often, it seems to me, the debates about the enormous limitations of the present economic system take place against complete ignorance of the awful historical record of the alternatives tried during the past century. This point is well made by John Gray, an emeritus professor of economics at the London School of Economics, an author of that fine book, False Dawn, The Delusions of Global Capitalism. During a fascinating online conversation sponsored by the Templeton Foundation, entitled, Does the Free Market Corrode Moral Character? Listen to what Gray had to say in that exchange. I quote, "The moral hazards of free markets do not mean that other economic systems are any better. Centrally planned systems have corroded character far more damagingly and with fewer benefits in terms of efficiency and productivity. The planned economies of the former Soviet bloc only function to the degree they did at all because they were riddled with black and gray markets. Corruption was ubiquitous. In the Marxian model, the greed-fueled anarchy of the market is replaced with planning based on altruism. But actual life in Soviet societies was more like an extreme caricature of laissez-faire capitalism, a chaotic and wasteful environment in which each person struggled to stay afloat. Homo homini lupu, man is wolf to man, was the rule, and altruism the exception. In these conditions, people with the most highly developed survival skills and the fewest moral scruples did best," is how Gray puts it. Equally insightful, it seems to me, are the comments by the French philosopher Bernard Henri Lévy, also in that interesting exchange sponsored by the Templeton Foundation. This is how Lévy puts it, I quote, "First, if the market corrupts, the various negations of the market corrupt absolutely. Look at fascism, and look at that other hatred of the market that preceded and followed it, communism. I doubt that anybody would posit communism as the fulfillment of character and soul for its victims or agents. Second, it is necessary to choose if these corruptions must be ranked. It is patently obvious that the communist or the fascist corruption through the negation of the market is significantly deeper, deadlier, and more irreparable than the first. That was obvious for fascism from the start, and it eventually became obvious for communism too. I think back, says Leby, to the long journey I made through Central and Eastern Europe just after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I can still hear my Czech, Polish, Bulgarian, Hungarian, and East German friends explaining to me that the communist era, those long decades in a society not at all governed by the rules of the market, had caused them, in their hearts and souls, to develop a certain number of vices, even defects, and that they themselves did not know how long it would take to get rid of them. Unquote. As someone, and I speak here for myself, whose work took him to Russia within a few months of the collapse of the former Soviet Union, and who lived and worked there for the next 4.5 years, I can fully support the assessments made by John Gray and Bernard Henry Leby. It is imperative that we refrain from fruitless debates about the relative merits of particular economic systems and succumb to the temptation of seeing contemporary problems, poverty, income disparities, climate change, as being purely manifestations of systemic failure. The reality, in fact, is considerably more complex. Countries which have been successful in boosting income per capita, in broadening the range of available opportunities for their respective populations, and in reducing the incidence of poverty are those where successive governments have taken a pragmatic approach to policy formulation and implementation, taking the best of an otherwise rich menu of options, and doing so in a context fairly free of useless, tired debates about whether the approach being followed was faithful or not to a particular ideology, capitalist, Marxist, or otherwise. You know, one can characterize as unjust the fact that South Korean citizens today have an income per capita that is 20 times higher than their fellow brothers and sisters in Ghana. But one cannot neglect the equally sobering fact that as recently as 1960, Ghana was actually ahead of South Korea in this key indicator. To attribute these differences to injustice, or to try to explain them in light of some inherent flaw in the capitalist system, is misleading and not particularly helpful. It is misleading because it fails to explain why some countries, such as Chile, South Korea, Singapore, New Zealand, Ireland, Taiwan, Malaysia, all the Nordics, the list is much longer, have done so well, capitalism notwithstanding. And it is unhelpful because it neglects the role of policy in precipitating constructive processes of change. To use an example, to say to any of the heads of state of Bolivia during the past 30 years that the country's poverty is the result of grave injustices in the capitalist system begs the question of why their next-door neighbor, Chile, has done so much better in improving living conditions. Most unhelpful, it completely sidesteps the issue of poor governance and the extent to which it is largely responsible for Bolivia's poverty. South Korea is a developed country, and Ghana and most of sub-Saharan African countries are not. The human beings living in these countries are all God's creatures. But the key challenge of development is identifying the factors, policies, and institutions which have led, in the case of South Korea, to high levels of per capita income, highly educated populations with labor forces that are skilled and are able to operate on the frontiers of technology, where economic activity takes place in a context of relative openness and transparency, with clear and predictable rules, where corruption is relatively rare and the government is made periodically legitimate through some form of vote, and so on, in the case of Ghana, have led to all the ills and tragedies that are in full evidence when one travels around the developing world. It is useless to pretend that there is no difference. The problems of poverty, lack of opportunity, and concern for the environment have little to do with faulty models, and less even with the presence or absence of capitalism, What is needed are honest and thoughtful leaders who will have credibility with the public and who will build institutions, improve the regulatory framework, manage scarce resources more effectively, and so on. An example will be useful by way of illustration. The primary mechanism of distribution in most modern societies is the government budget and the tax policy that underlies it. One of the more interesting experiences in this area is how the Nordic countries have managed to develop an economic model based on the provision of an extensive safety net, which involves relatively high levels of taxation, and at the same time managed to remain among the most competitive economies in the world, thereby disproving the fallacy that less government is always better because high taxes will discourage private initiative. Not at all, not at all. What matters is how the taxes collected are actually used. If they are often stolen or otherwise misused, then yes, high taxes will kill the private sector, which in turn will find ways not to pay them. But if, as in the Nordics, the tax revenue goes to education, to improving the country's infrastructure, to enhancing the skills of the population, to providing basic services, then not only will people and businesses pay them, but societies will flourish, as the case of South Korea illustrates. There is little point, it seems to me, in calling for a new development model. Quite aside from the practical problems associated with giving operational meaning to such calls, we have learned by now that not only is there no magic bullet to ensure sustainable development, but the ingredients of success are many in number. They vary from country to country in their relative importance, depending on their stage of development, and evolve over time. Furthermore, the issue has nothing to do with capitalism as a useless and stale concept in terms of its ability to help us understand better how to tackle world poverty and many of the larger number of global problems which we currently face. A more promising approach, I think, to this subject is to frame the discussion of world poverty, how to reduce it and how to do so in a context of respect for the environment, in terms of the identification of critical factors needed to generate processes of sustainable growth, without entering into a largely fruitless debate about the role of capitalism in helping or not helping us to get there. That debate may have been relevant and perhaps even interesting 30 years ago, but the world has moved on and governments are increasingly judged by voters, not for the extent of their ideological purity, but rather for the real results of their policies and the extent to which they contribute to improve people's prosperity and standard of living.